Thank you, Simon. Well, we're very privileged to have to open our summit today, Dr. Jonathan Kearns from the Reserve Bank. Jonathan has been a 25-year veteran of the Reserve Bank, including a stint at the Bank for International Settlements. So he's done many different jobs in the Reserve Bank. So he's very well rounded. And recently in July, he transferred to the head of domestic markets in the financial markets group of the Reserve Bank, coming from the head of financial stability in the financial systems group. He's here to talk about us this morning about a very key issue for, of course, property, which is interest rates, which are still going to increase, according to the Reserve Bank governor, and housing prices, which are probably still going to fall, according to the Reserve Bank governor as well. So Jonathan will fill us in on that and perhaps some other issues. At the end of his address, he will be available on stage here to answer a couple of questions from the floor. So please have some questions ready, of which I'll host in a very brief session. So can you please welcome to the stage Jonathan Kearns.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Jonathan. Well done.
Thank you, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today. It's a great pleasure to be here. The property market is always topical in Australia. News coverage and proverbial barbecue conversations always seem to fret that housing prices and property prices in general are either rising too quickly or that they're falling. The other topic that's always in the news is interest rates, particularly at the moment. Perhaps not surprisingly, interest rates and property prices have strong connections between them. The property market influences economic conditions and so indirectly affects interest rates. Housing constitutes around half of households' wealth. With increased housing prices, households feel wealthier and so they spend more. The increase in housing prices also means that homeowners can refinance their loans or choose to borrow more to finance consumption. Also, housing turnover, which tends to go hand in hand with rising property prices, results in increased spending on real estate services, removalists, durable housing goods, and so on. And an upturn in the property market increases investment. Owners spend more on renovations and buyers are more willing to put down a deposit. And that means the developers find it easier to get financing to commence a project. Of course, when property prices are falling, these effects all occur in reverse. There are many factors influencing economic conditions other than property prices. And the governor spoke in length about these just over a week ago and then again on Friday. So I'm not going to discuss these any further today. Instead, I want to focus on things going in the other direction. Why interest rates can influence property prices. First of all, I'm going to discuss the housing market and some of the estimates of how sensitive housing prices are to interest rates. And then I'm going to finish off talking a bit about the commercial property market. Interest rates affect the prices of all different types of assets, including housing. Assets are valued for what they give us in the future, so it's the future stream of incomes. That could be dividends, coupon payments, rent, housing services, or even future capital gains. Because the value of the asset depends on those future cash flows, a crucial element in valuing any asset is the interest rate used to discount those future cash flows. Or discounting those capital gains as well. An increase in interest rates means that a fixed amount of income at a future date is worth less today. So an asset with a future stream of payments is also going to have a lower price today. Of course, that future stream of cash flow can also be sensitive to interest rates. So that change in the future payments that are coming can either moderate or amplify the impact of interest rates on property prices. This channel from interest rates to prices is clearly important for property. In addition to the channel I've just talked about, There's a strong financing channel because property is typically financed with debt. Increases in interest rates reduce the maximum amount that can be borrowed, and they increase the cost of servicing a loan. In this way, higher interest rates also affect the property market by tightening the financing constraints for property buyers. A lot of media attention is placed on increasing interest payments by existing borrowers. But the higher interest rates, as I said, also affect the maximum loan size for prospective borrowers. In Australia, lenders work out the maximum loan size by figuring out the repayments on that size loan, added up with the expenses of the borrower, and seeing whether that exceeds income. Importantly, when they do this calculation for housing borrowers, they don't use the current interest rate. They're using an interest rate that's 3 percentage points above the current interest rate. A year ago, in order to reinforce financial stability of Australia, APRA increased this minimum serviceability assessment rate to 3 percentage points from 2.5 percentage points. That 50 basis point increase reduced the maximum loan size for housing borrowers by about 5%. At the time, it was reported that this measure would take the heat out of the housing market, and that's an exact quote from the AFR. The increase in the cash rate since May has been 225 basis points. And so this has had a much larger impact on maximum borrowing capacity than the increase by APRA 12 months ago. Given this 225 basis point increase has been fully passed through to borrowing rates, to mortgage lending rates, that has reduced the maximum borrowing capacity of new borrowers by around 20%, as you'll be able to see in this graph. And because the assessment rate that's used applies to any existing debt that a borrower has, the decrease in borrowing capacity is even larger for prospective borrowers who have existing debt, so particularly for investors. A change in the mortgage interest rates has a greater impact on new borrowing than a change in the serviceability rate, because it also affects the not only affects the maximum loan size, but importantly, it affects the actual repayments that borrowers have to make. So for example, the 225 basis point increase in mortgage rates that we've seen so far has increased the monthly repayments on a given size new loan by around 25%. This increase in mortgage payments will influence how much people want to borrow. As an aside, it's important to recognise that not all existing borrowers will have had an increase of this magnitude in their repayments. At the moment, just over a third of housing debt is on fixed interest rates, and so those borrowers won't experience an increase in their interest payments until their fixed rate matures. And what's more, a large share of variable rate borrowers have been making excess payments on their loan into either offset or redraw accounts. And for many borrowers, these large payments mean that they won't need to increase their actual interest, their actual loan repayments. The upcoming financial stability review, to be published in a few weeks in October, will delve into these issues in greater depth. Unsurprisingly, because higher interest rates reduce borrowing capacity and increase loan repayments, historically they've resulted in a decline in new housing borrowing. The timing and the strength of this relationship between interest rates and housing borrowing can vary, not least because the factors that interest rates are responding to, such as income growth, can directly affect housing demand as well. But there is no doubt that interest rates are a very important determinant of housing borrowing. Sometimes this impact on of interest rates on borrowing capacity or the size of loan repayments is used as a proxy for what impact that interest rates have on housing prices. But there are a number of reasons why such a rule of thumb is misleading. First of all, on borrowing capacity, most borrowers don't take out the maximum loan size that a bank will lend to them. In fact, in recent times, banks have reported that only around 10% of borrowers take out a loan that's close to the maximum size possible. As a result, even if all borrowers' maximum loan size is reduced by 20% in response to higher interest rates, not all borrowers will take out a loan that's 20% smaller. For many borrowers, the loan that they take out will only be marginally smaller, or perhaps not even smaller at all. And what's more, the deposit that those borrowers have will not net change with interest rates, so they've still got all of that capital to spend. Loan repayments typically represent a large share of the cost involved in property purchase, but there are also many other important costs. For this reason, a more complete framework for assessing the cost of home ownership is given by the user cost model. This model involves valuing housing based on how much it costs a user of housing. So it equates the cost of renting with the cost of ownership. To evaluate the cost of ownership, we have to take in all of the different components. So that's going to include the purchase and sale costs, the ongoing costs such as sale, as maintenance, repairs, rates, insurance, the physical depreciation, and the cost of borrowing, and then you need to take into account any potential capital gains. While a user cost framework for housing provides advantages for assessing the impact of interest rates on housing prices, it still does have limitations. That framework generally is imposing all of the change on interest rates onto the prices of housing, when we know that also rents can adjust in this framework. In the Financial Stability Review in April, we used the user cost framework to estimate that a 200 basis point increase in interest rates, which would increase mortgage payments and so the cost of borrowing, would reduce real housing prices by around 15% over a two-year period. While this 15% decline was commonly reported as being a forecast for housing prices, it was not really a prediction of how much housing prices were going to change. It was an estimate of how sensitive housing prices are to changes in interest rates, assuming that all other factors, the costs and benefits of housing, didn't change with interest rates. But many of those other factors do influence housing prices. For example, the demand for housing would be stronger if household income growth was stronger, if population growth was increasing through immigration, or there was a preference shift for people to live with fewer people in each household. And conversely, the supply of housing would also be lower than expected if construction turned out to be constrained in some way. These factors would all lead to stronger demand and weaker supply for housing, and as a result, prices and potentially rents would not fall as much as implied by interest rates acting in isolation. The impact of interest rates on housing prices, importantly, depends not only on how much interest rates change, but for how long. If interest rates were assumed to be 200 basis points higher forever in a user cost model, that would suggest that housing prices would end up being lower by around 30% compared to if interest rates had not changed at all. But notably, these estimates all depend on historical data, and they show that the change in housing prices occurs relatively slowly, and certainly much more slowly than asset prices respond to interest rates. The model suggests that if interest rates reverted to their initial level after that initial two-year period, then the interest rate effect on prices would be unwound. As I mentioned, an increase in interest rates increases the required repayments on a mortgage. In other words, rising interest rates increase the cost of borrowing to own a home. That effect is more or less immediate for borrowers on a variable interest rate. Most likely, it occurs within a month or maybe out to 3 months. But over time, the increase in interest rates works to reduce the demand for housing, and so housing prices will decline. Now that means that a household would need a smaller mortgage to purchase a first home, or if they're upgrading their home. So the estimates suggest that the net effect is that mortgage interest payments for a new borrower would be higher for around 2 years or so as a result of the higher interest rates. But after that, the decline in housing prices, and so mortgage sizes, begins to dominate. And so this exercise suggests that a borrower would actually have smaller mortgage payments as a result of the increase in interest rates, but decline in housing prices. And so that suggests that new borrowers would end up taking out smaller loans with smaller interest payments as a result. The sensitivity of housing prices to interest rates can also differ regionally or for different types of housing, like apartments versus detached housing. Some of my colleagues at the RBA studied this and found that the prices of different types of housing could have a different sort of response to changes in interest rates. They found evidence that controlling for other factors, interest rates can have a larger effect on housing prices in locations where housing supply is either less flexible, mortgage debt is higher, there are more investors, or income is higher. These estimates don't suggest that these factors cause housing prices to be more responsive to interest rates, but they certainly do highlight that the sensitivity of housing prices to interest rates is not going to be uniform across the country. What's more, the authors also found that housing prices in the most expensive areas are more sensitive to changes in interest rates. This matches the observation that housing prices in the most expensive locations historically have been more cyclical than in cheaper locations. Similarly, there's also some evidence that detached housing prices are more sensitive to changes in interest rates than are the prices of apartments. It appears that the limited supply of available zoned land partly explains this result. Overall, an increase in interest rates narrows the distribution of housing wealth, since more expensive properties experience a larger decline than cheaper properties. But the results suggest this distributional effect is only temporary. The effect of interest rates on cheaper and more expensive properties tends to converge over time. Turning now to commercial property, there have been many factors influencing the prices of commercial property in recent years, with differences across retail, office, and industrial properties. Retail property has faced headwinds from the shift to online retailing, which it picked up through the pandemic, as well as the compression of retail margins from the entry of international retailers. Office property faces uncertainty about the future demand given increase in hybrid and remote working. But in contrast, industrial property has experienced very strong demand as part of that shift to e-commerce. But the prices in all three of these segments will tend to be lower as a result of the increase in interest rates. Just like other asset prices, commercial property can be valued using the discounted future stream of net of expenses that comes from that property. The pass-through of changes in the risk-free interest rate, so the government sovereign bond rate, to the discount rate used to value commercial property has historically been quite drawn out. In part, this could reflect that because of the higher property transaction costs, there tend to be relatively fewer commercial property transactions, and that the lead times for those transactions tend to be much longer. The discount rates follow the broad trends in risk-free rates, or the sovereign interest rate, but reflecting that gradual pass-through, they are much smoother. The discount rates used to value commercial property exceed the risk-free rate because of the risk premium that compensates the owner for holding an asset, commercial property, that has a greater risk involved. The level of the commercial property risk premium can also change over time. And like risk premiums in financial markets, those risk premiums can often change with interest rates. In particular, an increase in interest rates that leads to a reduction in buyers' and investors' risk appetite is going to also tighten financial conditions. And so that's going to result in a higher risk premium, a larger discount rate, and putting more downward pressure on commercial property prices. But alternatively, if commercial property was seen as a hedge against inflation, so if we thought that future rents were going to increase with inflation, then an increase in interest rates because of higher inflation could actually reduce risk spreads for commercial property and result in less downward pressure on commercial property prices. All up, simple estimates suggest that commercial property prices have a fall in response to interest rates that's potentially a little bit smaller than for residential property, and it certainly seems to be slower. But this possibly just reflects that it's so hard to measure commercial property prices relative to what we have for residential property prices. So summing up, interest rates both affect residential and commercial property prices, and they're influenced by the economic effects that come from residential and commercial property prices. So we have a relationship in both directions. We can be pretty confident about some aspects of that relationship, about the impact of interest rates on property prices, but there is a lot of uncertainty about that. We know that increases in interest rates reduce the current value of future income, and they also tighten those financial borrowing conditions. And so higher interest rates reduce the value of both residential and commercial property, just as they do for any other financial asset that has future income streams. The response of property prices to interest rates tends to be drawn out. It occurs over years, not months. Given the other drivers of property prices, be it income or other things, we really don't ever get to disentangle the final impact on prices that comes from a change in interest rates. And then, as I noted, property prices are influenced by many other factors, such as future rents and risk premiums, and those factors can also change with interest rates. So overall, we know that higher interest rates will depress both residential and commercial property prices, but there's a lot of uncertainty about both the magnitude and the timing. Not only does that decline in property prices have implications for economic activity, it can also have important implications for financial stability. And that's something that we outlined significantly in the Financial Stability Review in April this year. Those risks to financial stability appear to be relatively contained for now because leverage in both residential and commercial property is relatively moderate for most buyers. But this is an area that we're going to continue to monitor very carefully, and so there'll be a lot more to be said in our next financial stability review in a few weeks' time. Thanks, everyone, and I'm very happy to take your questions.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. So we can turn to the floor. We've got from the Reserve Bank, one of the key policy wonks at the Reserve Bank, who is, I think, trying to reduce everyone's risk appetite just a little bit. Sounds like he's trying to drive down property prices a bit. So we welcome any. Here's your chance to have a question or two for Dr. Kearns. While we're waiting for that, Jonathan, clearly, as you set out, there's a lot of moving parts when you go and tighten monetary policy, push up the cash rate by 225 basis points from a record low period in an area where you've got very high housing prices. What is the Reserve Bank trying to achieve when it increases interest rates, looks for a fall in housing prices and perhaps commercial property prices, and then trying to achieve a reduction in actual house building and commercial property activity? Is it mainly that channel, or is it an overall wealth effect by making everyone feel just not quite as wealthy and buoyant because their house price or their commercial property portfolio is not quite as lucrative as they thought it was? Yeah. How do you think that actually works at this current moment?
Okay, thanks. That's a very topical question and very interesting at the moment. So, as the governor outlined just over a week ago in his Annika speech, and then again on Friday when he was appearing before the politicians in Canberra at the parliamentary testimony, you know, there are significant reasons why monetary policy has been tightened from exceptionally low levels because of high inflation. So there are many channels that interest rates operate through. And the wealth effect, the property market, is a significant one of those channels. But it's only one of those channels, so there are lots of other parts that are influenced there. But certainly one of the important channels that you do see is that any increase in interest rates is going to reduce asset prices. And that's affecting in equity markets, in commercial property, in residential property. And so that is an important wealth effect channel. And that's going to reduce consumption, it reduces turnover, and so the amount that people are spending, they need to go down to Bunnings less because they've just moved in and found that things don't fit or they need new furniture, all of those things. But then you're also going to see sort of some of those other effects that you referred to. So, you know, we know in Australia that mostly a lot of investment in property, particularly apartments, is financed when a buyer puts down a deposit and then the developer can go and get bank lending because they've got enough pre-sales. And so if you have a reduction in those pre-sales, then you're going to have a reduction in new investment construction as well. And so we see sort of a multiple series of channels where interest rates are impacting property. And so they're some of the important channels, certainly.
So we mentioned before the comparison between now and maybe the 1950s when unemployment was very low, mm-hmm. and inflation was high. We've got inflation high again, and we had, compared to, say, the late 1980s, when asset prices were booming and the Reserve Bank lifted interest rates up to 17 or 18%. Some people can remember that. Yeah. But back then, of course, the household sector was nowhere near as indebted. Mm-hmm. How much more sensitive now is the household sector, given they've got much more debt than they had before, mm-hmm. to interest rates even going up from even to still quite low levels historically?
Yeah. You know, that's a really good point. So household debt is clearly much higher than it was, you know, in the 1980s. And, you know, a lot of people look at the total level of household debt and notice that, you know, that's higher than sort of even the early 2000s. But if we take into account the amount that households have in their offset and redraw accounts, and so look at that sort of net concept of household debt, it actually hasn't really changed much relative to income compared to the early 2000s. So on that basis, the household sector as a whole is not going to be too much more sensitive. But of course, you know, you don't help me out when I've got high mortgage payments. And so we actually need to look at what's happening with individual borrowers rather than the aggregate of the household sector. So that distribution really matters a lot, which is why we put a lot of effort into understanding who has those large offset account and redraw facility balances and what borrowers have much smaller balances and so therefore are potentially going to be more sensitive both in their consumption and also, if they were to lose their job or have a shock to their income, what's the chance that they're not going to be able to keep up with their interest payments? So that distribution matters. So even at the aggregate sense, because net debt hasn't changed too much, we have to be very careful looking at that distribution, which is where we look for the risks.
But net debt's a lot higher, surely, than it was in the late 1980s.
Higher than the late 1980s, absolutely, yep. But hasn't changed so much relative to since sort of the early 2000s.
Yes. So as you mentioned, there's a lot of moving parts. And again, I will take questions from the floor if anyone puts their hand. There's a lot of moving parts. One is immigration. Mm-hmm. And we saw at the Jobs Summit, the government announced that in the budget, they'll announce an increase of immigration from, yep. I think, 160,000 to 195,000. Yep. That will put more demand into the system for housing. How much impact will that go in pushing prices sort of up, while I think you're trying to push them down, pushing them up.
Well, it's a really interesting point about what effect immigration will have on property market and property prices. And what really matters there is what immigration is relative to what's expected by the market. You know, and so we all know, and you know much better than me, that the lag in constructing a lot of new housing developments is going to be 18 months or longer, particularly when you're talking about large apartment complexes. And so developers are having to forecast what demand is that far out. And so changes in immigration flow that are unexpected can have a relatively sizable effect. And we saw some of that effect in the mid-2000s, where an unexpected increase in immigration seemed to have contributed a bit to the run-up in housing prices until the property sector could adjust to that increased flow and increase the construction rate a bit. So it's very much the forecasting and how that differs to
so
what's
expected. So would you be your judgment that the people in this room, the housing sector, have expected the increase in immigration that's coming or not?
I mean, I think there's been a lot of uncertainty about that. So, you know, we saw a very large unexpected decline in immigration with the pandemic. And the interesting thing there is that lots of people initially forecast that that reduction in population growth was going to have a big impact on property prices and depress residential property prices. But what we actually saw was that households responded and decided they wanted to live in fewer people per household, so what we call the household formation rate. And that offset the reduction in demand that was coming from reduced immigration. So there was that offsetting effect. So, but certainly it's the projection, the expectation of how much demand, you know, 2 years out is going to be, which is really important for the people in this room.
But does the Reserve Bank, and this is the point of the exercise, one of the mechanisms, are you seeking to reduce housing construction by lifting interest rates at a time when immigration might be going up?
But the Reserve Bank doesn't get to pick and choose which channels monetary policy operates. As you know, people frequently comment, monetary policy is a blunt instrument. It's affecting all parts of the economy. And we know that one of the channels that it's going to operate through will tend to be reducing construction. That's one of the effects that's out there. It's not necessarily a goal of the Reserve Bank, but it's a known aspect of how monetary policy will affect, along with all of the other channels where it will affect the economy.
Right. And we've got no more. We've also got, obviously, commercial property is a big part of all this, and you mentioned a bit of commercial property.
Yeah.
And classically in Australia, when we go through a bit of tighter money, sometimes there can be commercial property busts around the place, and we're seeing a few builders go under.
Yep.
What's your estimate of how this tightening phase might affect the commercial property sector?
Yeah, no, that's very important. And historically, both in Australia and internationally, we actually have tend to see that the commercial property market has a much bigger impact on the financial system and the banks than does residential property. So, you know, globally, if you look at the GFC, which we all think of as being a residential housing price bust, in most countries, the impact was actually greater on banks from their commercial property. So that's certainly something that we watch a lot. But in Australia, the banking system has very little exposure to commercial property. So for the banking system as a whole, the exposure to commercial property is around 6% of their assets. And for all banks, it's essentially in the single digits. So our banks are pretty well insulated against the commercial property market if there was a downturn. So we certainly wouldn't expect to see the effects that we saw in the late 1990s, for example, when the commercial property market had a really big impact on the banking system.
Okay. Well, we want to keep the schedule. We've given Jonathan some questions here. Please, everyone, can you put your hands together and thank Dr. Jonathan Kearns.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thanks, Michael.